Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. You're listening to the one-year anniversary special edition of this podcast. I want to start by thanking everyone who's listened to one or more episodes in all of the 98 countries where it has been downloaded. I hope you've enjoyed and learned a few things from listening to this podcast, and I look forward to many more episodes together. In this special anniversary episode, I talk to Joe Grunfest, the William A. Franke Professor of Law and Business at Stanford Law School. As some of you may recall, Joe was the very first guest of this podcast, so in this edition, we have skipped the traditional personal and professional background discussion and the rapid-fire questions at the end. Instead, we jump straight into the corporate governance hot topics, such as the current capital market environment, the state of crypto markets, the push for corporate board diversity, the state of stakeholder capitalism and ESG, and the implications of the recent ExxonMobil proxy fight for corporate directors. As I said in the intro for the inaugural episode, I consider Joe one of the top legal minds involving corporate governance. He is also an experienced director of public and private companies, in addition to being a former commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission. If you'd like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Joe, it is so good to see you again. This is the 35th episode of the Boardroom Governance Podcast. You are the special guest. You were the first guest. So I'm really happy that you're here again and that we can talk about governance again a year after we did the first program on May 12th. So how are you doing, first of all? And it's great to see you.
Hey, I'm doing great, but you're going to confuse everybody because this is a podcast and you're talking about seeing me. I've got a face for radio, I've got a face for podcasts, you know, and thrilled to be here with you, you know, 1 year into the pandemic.
True. I should say that I can see you because we're seeing you face to face, but this is only a recording for those listening on the podcast. So a lot of things have happened, Joe, in this year. I mean, what a crazy 2020, right? Like, this is for the history books. There's so many things. You know, I've been writing like a monthly newsletter, and it's so hard to keep track of everything in so many dimensions, right? Capital markets, politics, pandemic, economic issues. So let me start with something that is closer to us, which is capital markets, Silicon Valley. What do you make out of the record number of IPOs and SPACs? And in some ways, the revival of the public markets. How do you see this phenomena and how do you think about this?
Well, you know, there's a level at which it's all entirely rational. What we have is extraordinarily low interest rates. We have an environment where people are looking for the opportunity to gain returns and yield that just simply isn't available when interest rates are, you know, 1% or less than that. That creates an appetite for riskier investments, and these riskier investments are manifest either through IPOs or SPACs.
Entirely rational, you say. There's been 457 IPOs in 2020. They raised about $167 billion. The SPACs phenomenon is kind of the newer one, right? Where last year alone, there were 248 SPACs. They raised $83 billion. This year, they've increased the number of the full year of 2020. One narrative that we lived through over a decade in Silicon Valley is the idea of stay private for longer, right? Do you think this is dead? This is only a matter of timing? I mean, how do you think about the idea of the private company versus the public markets?
I think it's very segmented. And again, you can describe it as all being very rational. So suppose you've got a company that's looking for venture capital money. And suppose the VCs say, I'll just make up a number. We'll give you a pre-money valuation of $700 million. And then meanwhile, a SPAC promoter comes to you and says, I'll give you a pre-money valuation of $1.8 billion. Well, you know, you do the math. I got $700 million here. I got $1.8 billion over here. Which one am I going to take? Well, the path to a SPAC is complicated. You've got to be ready to do, in effect, an IPO. You've got to build a board of directors. You've got to build your, you know, internal finance function. And there are a bunch of companies who say if the gap between private market valuation and SPAC valuation is sufficiently large, I'm going to go SPAC myself.
Yeah,
I'm going to go get SPAC'd. And you know, that makes sense. And then you have an additional level of segmentation between the SPAC market and the IPO market. So you know, you think of it from the founder's perspective. They're going to do another round of financing. And in today's world, they have three different alternatives. Do another VC round, do a SPAC round, or do an IPO round, and they'll compare all three.
So the landscape in all these dimensions have changed a lot. Venture capital itself had a record year, $74 billion raised by VC funds, about $165 billion raised by startups, which is a record. So the venture money is flowing. In all dimensions, SPVs are a new thing where people are putting special purpose vehicles to invest in these private companies. The number of valuation multiples, Joe, in private companies have gone tremendously in the upside in companies in very short time frames. Is this all make sense? And as you said, rational that you can opt today for different vehicles, either in the venture financing, SPACs, IPOs, and private equity itself, as well as increased tremendously.
Oh, yeah.
$1 trillion, maybe $2 trillion of dry powder in private equity. Is this a new, have you seen a phenomena as similar as this one before in your career?
No, this is, it's not only in my career, it's historically unprecedented. And if what you want to do is take a perspective of macro forces driving micro consequences, what we have is unprecedented fiscal and monetary stimulus that's occurring throughout the United States and throughout global economies. And at one level, you can model everything that we're seeing now as a side effect of that. But what you would have to do is combine that with the observation that we really do have fundamental technological and economic change going on. The extent to which people are willing, and not only willing to, but want to and prefer to transact online. And we have a whole new generation of digitally native consumers coming to the marketplace. And we have tremendous advances in terms of data analytics and in terms of the kinds of services and functions that can be performed online. And you imagine evolutions to things like telehealth. I mean, if we're going to wind up bending the cost curve for medicine in the United States, we're not going to do it by delivering healthcare the way it's traditionally been delivered. There are so many innovations that are going to be coming along and that are absolutely necessary and that are facilitated by these new technologies that, you know, from that perspective, it makes sense to fund all of these different companies. And obviously, not all of them are going to survive. You know, don't be surprised if the majority of them crash and burn. But out of those heaping piles of ashes will emerge new Amazons and new Apples and new Microsofts. That's the way the process works.
Are you bullish, bearish? What do you think about the U.S. economy? And maybe on the market side, what do you think is going to happen in the industry, in the technology industry, because of all these different waves?
Well, you give me the question of bullish and bearish. Can I add the category confused-ish?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, because look, there's a level at which I am quite bullish about the fundamentals, but really very concerned about the valuations and the prices. Mm-hmm. So the reality is I love many of these opportunities. I think they're absolutely spectacular, but many of them are, how shall I say, fully priced. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way I'm approaching this market is, to the extent that it's possible, I'm trying to find things that have fantastic opportunities but aren't overpriced, aren't priced to a level where, you know, the phrase is priced to perfection. And if something is priced to perfection, it's more likely to go south.
So to add to that confused status, there is the crypto market. The crypto markets are another element that have really soared
this,
in the pandemic.
Hang on. Do you pronounce it Dogecoin or Doggycoin?
That's a good question. I I say Dogecoin.
No, that's, you're wrong. It's Doggy.
Am I? Okay.
It's Dogecoin. It's Dogecoin. It's not like the guy who used to be in charge in Venice. Now, come on. That's way too.
Although that's we already passed that, right?
You got the dog. You got the dog on the coin. It's Doggy Coin. It's not Dogecoin.
It's Shiba Inu, right? Now it's the new dog, like the
The Shiba Inu was in charge of Venice. Give me a break. Come on, it's Doggy Coin.
Well, here you have another. Should we call it an asset class? It reached $2.7 trillion at some point. Of course, Bitcoin's been there for over a decade, and we have a few days ago, El Salvador passed Bitcoin as the legal tender in the country, which is an incredible development.
And which, by the way, has knock-on legal ramifications in the United States that are potentially quite serious that most people haven't gotten their arms around.
They do or they don't?
They hadn't. All right. And I think they're just going to start facing that in the coming weeks because there are a variety of U.S. legislative provisions that categorize things as currency.
Yeah.
And the test for currency is whether it's legal tender in some recognized foreign jurisdiction. Well, to my knowledge, Bitcoin was not legal tender in any foreign jurisdiction until our friends in El Salvador, right? Mm-hmm. Started to say, hey, you want to buy lunch? You can buy lunch with Bitcoin. Well, now that it's legal tender in El Salvador, does it have to be treated as a formal currency under federal and state law? And, there are probably armies of associates at law firms doing, 50 state surveys. All right now, trying to figure out what's the definition of currency in Nebraska. And now that Bitcoin is a legal currency in El Salvador,
And it's huge because of the capital gains tax and many other implications.
Money, yeah, right. And money transfer laws in the United States and the question of whether you treat it as a security, even though the SEC says, as he says in his speech, it hasn't taken a formal position that it's not going to treat it as a security. I mean, the knock-on effects of what El Salvador did, I don't think El Salvador understands.
Yeah. And by the way, it was 2 days ago on Twitter Space, you had the president go live and you had 20,000 people on Twitter listening to him as the bill was passed. I mean, it did have certainly an historical feature to it. I think we are living through extraordinary times. But maybe taking that point aside, many public companies in the U.S. have added Bitcoin to their treasuries, notably MicroStrategy.
Wait. Not many.
About a dozen.
That's not many.
No? Okay.
Okay. I mean, yeah, there are thousands of publicly traded companies.
Sure, sure.
So don't give me many.
Okay.
A few people. All right.
Okay.
Have basically inhaled more than once. All right. Have decided to take a portion of their corporate treasury and put it into Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Overstock. Okay.
Yeah.
Primary example.
Square. Coinbase.
Square. Yeah. To a lower degree, Coinbase is transacting in it, not actually holding it.
It's got a little bit.
It's right. Okay. But you can get. There are a small number of publicly traded companies that will have high correlation with Bitcoin prices, all right? And Tesla is not one of them. And they're not taking, all right, Bitcoin anymore for their cars because they realize that Bitcoin is basically dirty, 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 right? Mining Bitcoin is like the dirtiest business that you can possibly be in. And if you care about global warming, you shouldn't be against all crypto, all right? You should be against proof of work crypto that eats up huge amounts of energy in order to validate the blockchain. There are other forms of crypto, whether it's proof of stake, whether consensus, what have you. There are other techniques that will not kill us and poison the planet. Bitcoin, dirty, dirty, dirty.
No, and I feel like maybe Elon Musk felt the weight of ESG, right? And Tesla being the climate friendly. And it's weird that he didn't know that, but.
He didn't know that. What can it mean? Maybe he's hard to believe he did not know that.
Yeah.
he may not have connected the dots. He may not have realized that, you know, maybe he was more interested in being a Bitcoin hero, right? And getting more, you know, attention in the Twitterverse than thinking about the intellectual inconsistency and the planet heating consequences of his passion for Bitcoin. And by the way, don't ask me to explain how Elon Musk thinks. I can't do that. And I am very proud of the fact that I cannot do that.
You know, what's weird, a year ago in our first episode, we talked about Elon as well when we were talking about D&O insurance and he was insuring his own directors for liability purposes. So here we go.
I guarantee you a year from now, we'll still be talking about Elon. That's the safest bet.
DeFi, what do you think about DeFi, which is decentralized finance, Ethereum-based? I mean, that's a different, as you said, proof of stake. There's a whole slew of new technologies that are very significant, right? We have companies or technologies like Uniswap, like Compound, like there's a whole industry being born on this idea that you can decentralize finance. Any thoughts on that side?
Yeah. Once the regulators figure out what's going on here, they're going to try to crush it. Because from their perspective, the extent to which this can be destabilizing will potentially be very threatening. And I think part of it will be an overreaction and part of it will be an underreaction. And you know, the question is, to what extent can the regulatory structure wind up coexisting with something like DeFi? And to the extent that DeFi, and not all DeFi is about what I'm about to describe, to the extent that DeFi is built on the equivalent of a libertarian ethos, which is designed basically to flip the bird to the man and to basically say, we can run stock exchanges and we don't have to worry about regulators. That's not going to end well. That will not end well for a million different reasons. And again, let's recognize we're very early in the DeFi process. And the regulators haven't figured out what to do with crypto, right? You know, the SEC has no idea what to do with crypto. The SEC is asking for legislation. They're actually begging for legislation, because if you get legislation, then it's not their job, unless, right, the SEC's nightmare is Congress gives the SEC all the authority it needs to regulate crypto and says to the SEC, here, you go do it.
Would Gary Gensler, who taught cryptocurrency at MIT, be a better person to lead the SEC in this task?
Well, obviously, it's better to have somebody who understands crypto than somebody who doesn't understand crypto. And you know, Gary would clearly be, you know, top quartile with regard to, you know, but there's a level of, how shall I say, governance judgment that comes in over here, where you can have people who are very knowledgeable about crypto with different perspectives about human nature and how organizations operate, reach different conclusions as to how crypto should appropriately be regulated. So, you know, the way I'd look at it is, you need to have a sufficiently sophisticated understanding of what's happening, not what's happening now, but what the trajectory is and what's possible, because these things evolve very quickly, right? And you got to skate to where the puck is going to be, not to where it is.
And one area where I feel governance or corporate governance is being, I wouldn't say disrupted, but being questioned is the creation of these decentralized autonomous organizations, which takes away or tries to reorganize entities and business ventures in through tokens. Any thoughts on the on these decentralized autonomous organizations from a governance perspective? Too early?
They can lead to chaos. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what is the governance structure? Each one of these has a very different governance structure. And one of the things that we know is that there's no perfect governance structure. Mm-hmm. All right. It's no, If you want to over-intellectualize, go back to the arrow and possibility theorem, where Ken Arrow, who won the Nobel Prize for this work and lots of other things, demonstrated that there are lots of criteria we would like to see in a society, and you can't simultaneously have them all. Well, you know, that's a super brainiac way of saying, you know, governments are always going to fail to one degree or another. And why should that be any different? Because you just put the problem on the blockchain. Putting the problem of social organization on the blockchain does not solve the problem of social organization. It simply replicates the problem on the blockchain.
Right.
So why people think that putting an insoluble problem on the blockchain solves the insoluble problem is an insoluble problem to me.
Okay. And last question on crypto. Years ago, even when I was at Stanford, there was a new Bitcoin center started at Stanford, where you were a part of it. And Dan Bonet and many others at Stanford, Stanford being a very, you know, leading cutting edge university with computer science.
We are very crypto. We are crypto deep.
Crypto deep. Which is interesting, because when we talk to the computer scientist, very different view. Maybe us lawyers are more skeptical of everything.
Well, you know what can I say? The computer science people don't get sued 25 times. You know, and in computer science, your equations are generally fairly well behaved. And if you write a system, you know how it's going to operate.
Fair.
We're lawyers. We deal with people. Not only deal with people, we deal with plaintiffs.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're people, sometimes they're not. I don't know what they are sometimes. But it's a very different problem. I mean, look, in engineering, you're often dealing with fairly well-behaved systems. If systems were well-behaved, you wouldn't need lawyers. So, you know, what can I say? I go only where there's chaos and mayhem.
Only where chaos and mayhem. Well, let's switch gears and go back to our corporate governance trends. One of them is board diversity. And the board diversity push has come from many different places. Investors, institutional investors. We have in California new legislations, SB 826 a couple years ago, AB 979 just recently. NASDAQ has proposed to the SEC the new diversity rules, where you have to have a woman and a diverse member on the board. Goldman Sachs is saying they're not taking companies public without a woman on the board. What do you make out of all this diversity push? And do you have any specific thoughts on what's going to happen, at least from the California side, with these legislations in terms of companies implementing these rules?
Yeah, well, a couple of observations. First, I'm a huge fan of board diversity. I think it's a good idea for many, many, many different reasons. And we have two pieces of legislation here in California. SB 826, which is a quota. It requires a minimum number of women on the boards. And then we have AB 979, which is another quota, which requires a certain minimum number of directors to be of certain racial groups, national origin groups, or have certain sexual orientations. Now, the data suggests pretty strongly, almost conclusively, that SB 826 has worked, that the number of women on corporate boards in California went up very dramatically after the enactment of SB 826. And the vast majority of corporations in California are now in compliance with SB 826. And it's only a very small number of corporations that tend to be microcaps. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if many of them are in the process of delisting or going away, all right, that haven't complied. So the number of women on corporate boards has increased very significantly, particularly in California over the last several years, and it's going to continue to increase. The push towards diversity is really very significant. Now, figuring out the effect of AB 979 is more difficult. There has, over the last few months, been a noticeable increase in the number of Black directors. and also Hispanic and other, you know, minority directors going onto corporate boards, particularly Black directors. But it's very hard to separate that out from what I call the George Floyd effect, because the terrible murder of George Floyd occurred in close proximity chronologically to the passage of 979. So when you look at those things together and you see the subsequent increase, it's hard to say that it wouldn't have occurred one but for the other, or whether it's the combination of the two. So we don't know, and statistically, I don't think we will ever know. But there's a deeper mystery here, and something that I think is really more profound. And that's, if you look objectively at both pieces of legislation here, and if you ask yourself, what's the probability that the United States Supreme Court, as currently composed with its 6-3 conservative majority, would find that either one of these pieces of legislation is constitutional? The answer would be a resounding no.
Yeah.
This court is highly likely to find the legislation unconstitutional. Now, that's fascinating. First, let's respect the idea that there are many people who think that these bills should be constitutional. I get that, but that's not the question I'm asking. I'm asking you to act like a bookie in Las Vegas. Where would you put the odds? Where would you put the over-under that our current Supreme Court would support, would find this legislation constitutional? The odds against that would be very, very strong. And then that gives rise to the most fascinating observation here, I think. No corporation has sued and has made the argument that these provisions are unconstitutional. Nobody of substance, I mean, there are two or three lawsuits that are bouncing around. They're brought by a, right of center public policy group down in Southern California. The one brought in federal court has basically been kicked out on standing grounds, and the one in state court is moving very, very slowly, and may also wind up getting kicked out for a variety of reasons. But the fascinating thing is, typically when legislation is potentially unconstitutional, everybody is jumping up and down and they're suing to get it invalidated. Here, not only is that not happening, but the vast majority of corporations are complying with legislation where their lawyers are telling them, if you wanted to sue, this is unconstitutional. And all the corporations are going, we don't want to sue. So these bills are what I would call the miracle of unconstitutional legislation. These are the most effective unconstitutional pieces of legislation that I've ever seen in American history. And I think the answer for why they exist and have been so successful is that, at least when it comes to legislating the composition of corporate boards, the majority of America is out of tune with the Supreme Court doctrine regarding the existence of quotas. So it seems that legislators in California, and probably the majority of the California electorate, are perfectly fine with quotas for corporate boards, but they're totally opposed to quotas for government contracting. They're totally opposed to quotas for admission to universities. When we have a look at the results of, the recent referendum with regard to affirmative action, where it lost, right, resoundingly, California doesn't want, right, the California electorate does not want affirmative action for, entry into the UC college system. So we have this fascinating situation. Mm-hmm. Diversity on corporate boards is being treated very differently than diversity in other areas of society. And the parties most directly affected aren't complaining about it. It's a remarkable situation.
And one issue I heard you talk about previously is that it would be in the interest of the California Attorney General not to enforce the law because it would open up a potential constitutional challenge that they would lose
Yeah, you know, this is really deep in the weeds, but the law of standing in California is different than federal standing law. And there's a doctrine of taxpayer standing that as long as the government is spending any money to promote an objective that's arguably unconstitutional, any taxpayer can sue and has standing. So if you want to get rid of the pending California litigation, the state, you know, the Secretary of State could simply say, all right, we're not spending any money enforcing this. Well, and here's the thing. You don't have to spend any money in order to enforce this and get compliance. You simply pass the standard. It appears the standard is then a social norm.
Right.
Everybody's complying, even though they know that it's unconstitutional. If they'd litigate it, they'd probably win.
Yeah.
So you know, it's really the sleeves off your vest to say that if you want to get rid of the California state legislation, just stop enforcing the bill.
Right. Yeah. Another big topic, and I suppose it's sort of related, has been the politicization of CEOs and the role of corporations in, you know, political spending and other issues, broader stakeholder visions, which is, hey, now we got to think about all the stakeholders, right? Employees and you know, you have the consumers and the community.
You had to think about them all the time anyway.
Anyway, yeah.
This is nothing new. You're going to run a corporation, you're not going to care about your employees, you're out of business in 30 seconds. You're going to run a corporation, you're not going to care about your customers, good luck to you. You're going to run a corporation, you're not going to care about the communities in which you exist, they're going to kick you out of town. All right. You always, always, always had to consider all of these constituencies. Otherwise, you're out of business.
So you think the Business Roundtable statement of 2019 doesn't do much, really?
Oh, that depends. Mm-hmm. You see, because emphasis matters. And if corporate executives and corporate boards just sort of say, well, you know, before we had a monomaniacal desire to maximize profits and we were willing to be rapacious and non-compromising in that objective, and we're willing to ground our employee rights into dust in order to get another penny for dividends, you know, that's one approach. Another approach is, you know, We can rebalance within the business judgment rule. And one of the things that I think some people learn when they rebalance is that they actually wind up doing better. Look, you know, I was a co-founder of a company, Financial Engines, and one of the philosophies that we followed was we wanted to overpay. All right. So If our comp consultant came to us and said, you know, the going rate for this job, I'll make up a number. You know, and again, we tended to hire, you know, very sophisticated people in the whole bit. So going rate is 200,000. I'd sort of say, you know, let's offer 220 and let's get the really, really best people. Because the difference between a person who's good at a job and a person who's really the best at a job is remarkable. All right. Going from 90th percentile to 99th percentile. Wow. And if you can get that for a 10% premium, all right, in wages and salary, I'm saying let's pay up. So you know, it was a strategy that we followed. It's a strategy that I think we followed effectively. All right. We wanted the, and you know, you do that, you get the best people. Turnover is so hugely expensive. All right. You know, you get the best people and you love them. All right. And you give them really good stuff to work on and you keep them interested and you keep them engaged. You know, then you wind up and you say, well, you know, the total cost of employment, if you look at it long term, taking into account reduction in turnover, higher productivity, better teamwork because you've got better people, you save money by paying more than the going rate.
So. And I agree, obviously, and the focus now has been a lot more on employees, certainly in Silicon Valley, because competition is so hard and you want to get the best people. But we just saw last week probably the most expensive proxy fight in the history with the vote of ExxonMobil, where you had a tiny investor activist who put $30 million into this campaign.
Turns out they spent less than $30 million.
Incredible.
We had a session with the people that run Engine Number One, the organization, the insurgents that went up against Exxon, and they disclosed that they spent less than 30. Meaningfully less. They didn't give a number, but it'll come out.
If that's the case, right? And then Exxon spent $35 million. This little engine won the fight with three board seats. ExxonMobil being the most known oil company in the United States, kind of a symbol. What do you make out of this and the effect on boards of directors?
Oh, this is huge. This is epical. I think going forward, every proxy contest is going to be measured as either before Exxon or after Exxon. One way to think about it is this. The equity position that they had in Exxon was 0.02%. Mm-hmm. 2 basis points. In order to win, you need to get 50% of the votes cast. So if you look at the equivalent of electoral leverage, they basically leveraged their position, which was not even a toehold. It was a toenail hold. Right? They leveraged it by a factor of 2,500. Right? Absolutely remarkable. And what it demonstrates is that in today's world, you don't need a large equity position. What you really need to understand is, what is the story that is going to resonate with the large institutional investors? And Engine Number One had a terrific story that resonated extraordinarily well. They had the perfect target because Exxon had built up a reputation over decades as being the most arrogant corporation in the United States that basically refused to listen to institutional investors. You combine that with the big push towards ESG investing and the fact that many institutions now feel they can't afford to be on the wrong side of ESG momentum. You know, it created a situation where if you were economically and politically smart, and these guys I think are, you would be able to leverage your position by a factor of 2,500 and grab 3 seats on the Exxon board of directors. They did something that people thought would have been impossible. And I think it's highly innovative, and you're going to see many forms of what I would call corporate electoral innovation over the next year or two. And a lot of it will wind up pushing in the ESG direction.
Yeah. And this obviously impacts all of corporate governance, at least on the public side, and certainly the role that you need to have and the relationships with your shareholders, and this is going to create many more stories. ESG, to me, I mean, I think the number is $1.9 trillion has been pushed into ESG, 1,900 funds. Yeah. And when you read Larry Fink's letter, and all the institutional investors are pushing this agenda.
Yeah, and you know, you have a look at this morning's Wall Street Journal, and it points out the incoherence of ESG. All right, there are many situations where individual companies are rated very highly under one metric and very low under another. And you've got situations where, you know, good ESG portfolios are underperformed by bad ESG. Look, my joke line about ESG is, given the current state of the art, it stands for extremely subjective guessing.
All right? Joe, you told me that a year ago, but it stayed in my head. So We continue with the extremely subjective guessing.
I was right a year ago. I'm right. Still right today. I'm tired of being, you know, Evan, I am so tired of being so right about so many different things. What can I say?
Joe, this is so good to see you again. It's so good to talk about these issues. I know we could be on and on in many of these different topics. But thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your views.
Evan, and the most important thing that we discussed, obviously, it's doggy coin.
Doggy coin.
Repeat after me. Doggy coin, not doggy coin.
Not Dutch coin.
Doggy coin.
All right, Joe. Have a great weekend. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Be well.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.